Hello, my name's Tony Hazel. I'm a GP and an e-learning fellow for the RCGP. Welcome to the Allergy Podcast. I'm here today with Dr. Susan Leach. Susan, could you introduce yourself to our listeners and explain your interest in food allergy?
My name's Susan Leach. I'm a paediatric allergist and I work at King's College Hospital, where I've worked for the last 18 years. We run a busy children's allergy service, and most of the children that we see have some kind of food allergy. I got interested in food allergy after working in a district general hospital, and I saw a couple of twins who were doing an egg challenge, and they became very itchy after eating egg, and I was amazed that food could cause a reaction in a child like that. And then I became fascinated by the fact that you can measure the allergy antibody in your blood. So people with an allergy to egg actually have an antibody against egg floating about in their blood, which is responsible for the allergic reactions. I then went on to work in Oxford, where I did a food allergy clinic alongside an immunologist and learnt a lot from that. Then I did a master's in medical immunology in London, and then set up the Children's Allergy Service at King's.
So if you're seeing a child in clinic, how would you assess them? How would you go about assessing someone who presented with a suspected food allergy? And would that be different if it was a child or an infant compared to if it was an adult?
So the key to making a diagnosis of food allergy is taking something called an allergy-focused clinical history. And basically, this is a clinical history where you ask a lot of questions about the nature of the reaction that the patient had to the food. You need to know how soon after they ate the food that they had the allergic reaction and what the symptoms were. And you can use the symptoms to decide whether or not this is IgE-mediated food allergy or non-IgE-mediated food allergy. So IgE-mediated food allergy, they occur within an hour of the person eating the food, and then they resolve within 24 hours. For non-IgE-mediated allergic reactions, the reactions are a lot more chronic and often less severe, and they can happen over several days, up to 72 hours after the patient's eaten the food.
So it sounds like non-IgE-mediated are some of the things that we might not so easily recognise as allergy.
I think so. I think when a lot of people talk about allergy, they often think about the immediate, sort of more severe allergic reactions. But there's also this spectrum of allergic disease that when I speak to general practitioners, they say the majority of what they see is actually non-IgE-mediated food allergy.
Are there any other questions that you'd ask in your allergy-focused history, apart from the actual symptoms that the patient's presented
with? So the kind of symptoms that the patient has are also a key to deciding whether or not it's IgE-mediated or non-IgE-mediated. A child who's having an IgE-mediated allergic reaction will get urticaria, angioedema, they might get wheezing or difficulty breathing. And a child that's having a non-IgE-mediated allergic reaction will have abdominal pain, colic, vomiting, diarrhea, a flare-up of their eczema a day or so after they've eaten the food. If the patient develops urticaria within an hour after eating the food, then it's a better indicator that it's a food allergy, whereas if occasionally you get a patient who claims that they're allergic to some kind of food, but you find that the urticaria developed a few hours after they'd eaten the food and then continued for several days. And that, to me, tells me that it's more likely to be a viral urticaria, for example.
In primary care, it can be sometimes difficult to know when to test for allergies and when testing is going to make a difference to our management and when we should be referring rather than testing. Can you outline a bit the sort of thought process that I might go through in primary care presented with a child with a possible allergy?
Yeah, so once you've taken your allergy-focused clinical history and you've decided, is this an IgE-mediated or a non-IgE-mediated allergic reaction, you can use that to decide whether or not any more tests or investigations are needed. If it's if you put the symptom package together and you think that the child has a non-IgE-mediated allergic reaction, there are no tests or investigations that you can really do for that. And what you have to do is then suggest to the patient that they stop eating the food that seems to be causing the reaction. And it needs to be for about 4 to 6 weeks, followed by reintroduction to see whether or not the symptoms come back again. If it was a particular pattern of symptoms with an immediate reaction that you thought the child had IgE-mediated an allergic reaction, then you'd need to do some allergy tests. That means doing a blood test, which is a specific IgE allergy blood test. And you have to request the allergen which the patient had the allergic reaction to. So the laboratory, they can test for up to 200 different types of food. So you have to specify which particular food it is that you want the child tested for.
I can see that if you have a reaction that the parent has come in and say, my child eats this, and then they get a reaction, then it's quite easy to work out what to test for. It sounds like with non-IgE-mediated allergies, it might be a bit more difficult to work out what the food is, because it doesn't happen straight away. The child has strawberries and they come out in a rash. What are the most common food allergens?
IgE-mediated allergic reactions, they're referred to as the Big Eight. And those are cow's milk, eggs, fish, shellfish, peanuts, tree nuts, wheat, soya. And we also include sesame as well, although it's not one of the Big Eight, but it's an increasingly important and common allergen.
So would it be a reasonable thing if you've got a child with a reaction, with an IgE-mediated sound reaction, where the parent can't identify the food, to test for all those eight, or is that a bit too scattergun?
I think it's a bit too scattergun. I think if the patient's really not sure, what we see in clinical practice is usually if it's a peanut or a tree nut allergy, then because these are foods which are eaten relatively infrequently, then you usually get a pretty good history of them eating a nut and then having an allergic reaction. If it's something that it's less clear, then obviously things like milk and eggs. It also depends on the age of the child as well. So if you've got a child who's, say, under 2 years of age, then milk and eggs are common allergens. And as children get older and their diet gets more varied, then things like nuts, sesame can become more of a problem.
Another decision in primary care is we don't like sticking needles in children unless we actually absolutely have to. So am I going to do IgE tests, or am I just going to refer them to the allergy clinic? Can you talk me through how I might make that decision?
Okay, so in the allergy clinic, we use skin prick testing to determine whether or not a child has IgE-mediated allergic reactions. If you were going to refer a child to an allergy clinic anyway, then maybe a specific IgE test wouldn't add anything to the patient pathway.
Could you talk me a bit through the interpretation of allergy tests? Because it's something that we don't request very often, and then it pops into my inbox and I'm thinking, oh, I requested this test, but I'm not sure I know what to do with the results.
You need to know, is the test positive or is it negative? So a patient who isn't atopic, doesn't have a tendency to have allergic reactions, their specific IgE will be completely negative, and that's less than 0.35 KUA per litre. But if it's raised above that, then that patient has specific IgE to that particular allergen. The patients which are tricky are patients with eczema, because patients with eczema have a lot of non-specific IgE, which often binds as part of the allergy tests. So you often find that all of their specific IgE is slightly raised, and they can be a little bit harder. So you may accept a higher specific IgE in a patient with eczema.
So would the fact that a patient has eczema tip the balance towards referring them rather than doing an IgE because they're harder to interpret?
I think it depends on what it was that the patient had the allergic reaction to. If the patient's got eczema and had an allergic reaction to one type of food, then you could measure specific IgE to that. And a child that has reactions to multiple foods, then ideally they should be referred to an allergy clinic.
In primary care, we get a lot of parents coming and saying, my child has an allergy, can they have an EpiPen? I'm nervous about them at school. And it's difficult to know when to start one in the absence of a particular opinion from a consultant. How would you make that decision?
So the decision as to whether or not to prescribe an EpiPen, we're usually quite clear about that. And that's any child that's had a severe allergic reaction. And what we mean by a child who has a severe allergic reaction is a reaction which involves wheezing or difficulty breathing, collapse, loss of consciousness, drowsiness. If it's a child that just has angioedema or itch or a rash, then those allergic reactions can be managed with antihistamines. The only exception to that would be a child who has asthma, because having asthma as well puts you at risk of having more severe allergic reactions. So any child with asthma, then we also prescribe an adrenaline auto-injector for. If you're prescribing an adrenaline auto-injector, it's important. There's three different types, and it's important that the child or the parent or carer needs to know how it should be used and when it should be used as well.
And they've been in the news a lot lately, obviously, the adrenaline auto-injectors, and I know there's been some stuff around about EpiPen and the length of the needle and whether or not we should be using that. And probably for a small child, that's not so relevant. But for a teenager, would you go with one of the other brands over EpiPen, or have you not?
Yeah, so there are three different types of adrenaline auto-injectors. There's Jext and EpiPen and Emerade. And all of them from time to time seem to have supply issues, which is why it's quite helpful having a choice of different types of auto-injector. The EpiPen and the Jext have 300 microgram doses as their top dose. The Emerade has a 500 microgram dose as its top dose. And it's also got a longer needle. So there's some theoretical benefit in using that for patients that are over 60 kilograms or adult patients.
Okay. And if we do have to change brand, which, as you said, we sometimes do because the pharmacy rings us up and tells them they can't get them, does the patient then need to be retrained? Do they all have a different mechanism or are they similar?
Yeah, they're all similar, but some of them have slightly different ways in which they're administered.
So they're all slightly different, and I'm not sure actually that I do sort of train my patients in them. If someone who has used one is then prescribed another, do you think it would be acceptable to just say, get the pharmacist to show you how to use it? Should they be coming up to your clinic?
I think the pharmacist should be able to demonstrate how to use each of the different adrenaline auto-injectors. And also each of the companies provides patient information as well. There's a lot of literature and trainer pens that you can get. And each of the different companies have websites where you can get information about how to use each of the adrenaline pens.
We wanted to cover oral allergy syndrome, and I must admit I get oral allergy syndrome, so I've got a particular interest in this. Could you tell us a bit about what it is and the principles of cross-reactivity?
Okay, so oral allergy syndrome, the term that we're using at the moment is pollen food syndrome. And the typical story that you get from the patient is that they start off with hay fever, and it's usually spring hay fever. And the pollen that they're reacting to is silver birch pollen. And the problem with silver birch pollen is that there are allergens in the silver birch pollen which then cross-react with certain fresh fruit and vegetables. And it's typically things like apples and then stone fruit such as cherries or nectarines. And it's the raw fruit that patients have reactions to. So the protein that causes oral allergy syndrome or pollen food syndrome is broken down very quickly. It's broken down by digestion, it's broken down by heat, which means that patients that have reactions to apples, it's fresh apples, it's not baked apples or apple crumble. And usually the reactions aren't severe, so they're quite intense and unpleasant, but as soon as the food goes down into the stomach, it gets broken down by stomach acid and gets digested. So the patients don't have severe allergic reactions the way that somebody with peanut allergy might have it.
Would you treat it just with an antihistamine?
Yeah, antihistamines are fine. Some people, they just wait for the symptoms to wear off.
Is it antihistamines that are the mainstay?
Yeah, antihistamines are the treatment for most allergic reactions.
Is there any particular differences in which ones you might use for a child or for any given allergy?
So the ones we tend to prescribe are the long-acting non-sedating antihistamines. So these are things like cetirizine or loratadine. And avoiding the antihistamines such as pyriton or chlorphenamine unless the children are very young.
So moving on to cow's milk protein allergy, which I think is something that causes quite a lot of anxiety in general practice. A lot of parents come in convinced their child has it and asking for special milks, which are very expensive, so we want to prescribe them only when they're indicated, and as you said, waiting lists to get an opinion from specialists are often quite long. So how would I approach that in primary care? What symptoms might make me worry?
Okay, so about 3% of infants have cow's milk protein allergy. And again, what you need to do is decide, is it IgE-mediated or is it non-IgE-mediated? If it's IgE-mediated, the child might be getting an urticarial rash or swelling or redness. The first time that they were given a bottle of milk formula with non-IgE-mediated symptoms, I think these are much harder to establish. So this is a child with colic, vomiting, diarrhea, which I suspect is probably very common in young babies, or a flare-up of their eczema. With non-IgE-mediated milk allergy, the only thing that you can do is to remove milk from the child's diet and then replace it with something else. With IgE-mediated reactions, you may want to do a specific IgE allergy blood test. But either way, you need to put the child onto a milk-free diet to see whether or not the symptoms improve. With non-IgE-mediated symptoms, I guess the question is, at what point decide to try that once you have a child that's presenting with a lot of fairly non-specific symptoms? We usually say a child, for example, with gastroesophageal reflux that's not responding to routine treatment, and similarly a child with colic, you might want to consider putting them onto a milk-free diet if there's a family history of allergic disease. And then the question is, if you're going to put them onto a milk-free diet, which milk-free diet are you going to put them onto? Infants that are breastfed, so if a mother's breastfeeding, anything that she's eating is going to be coming out through her breast milk. So if you think that the baby may be reacting to milk protein in the mother's breast milk, then the mother needs to put herself onto a milk-free diet. So you'd need to give her some advice about that, and please recommend a calcium supplement, because otherwise they end up with fractures. If it's a formula-fed baby, or the mother wants to stop breastfeeding and for example to go back to work, then you would, if the child's under 6 months, you would need to prescribe an alternative milk formula. And what we recommend is an extensively hydrolyzed milk formula. So there's various milk formulas on the market that are extensively hydrolyzed. Sometimes babies, if they don't settle on one, you might want to swap them onto another to see if you can find one that suits them a bit better. Weigh the baby. If the baby seems to be dropping their centiles or not thriving, then they may need to be referred up to an allergy clinic, or if it's really not thriving on an extensively hydrolyzed formula, you may need to switch them onto an amino acid formula, which are the very expensive ones.
And is it the same thing, a 4 to 6 week exclusion diet and then reintroduce? You're looking for the symptoms to go and then to come back?
Yes, that's correct.
One thing that causes a lot of anxiety to parents, and I have to say often to their GPs as well, is when a child suddenly has blood in their nappy. And I know that can sometimes be allergy, and obviously it can sometimes be something much more serious. How would you approach that situation?
From an allergy perspective, if it's a well baby who suddenly produces blood in their nappy, then we usually make the diagnosis of cow's milk protein proctocolitis. This is inflammation of the lower part of the bowel in a response to cow's milk protein. If the baby's being breastfed, then sometimes the symptoms occur after a mum's had a couple of lattes and then has a lot of milk protein in her breast milk, and then the baby starts to get symptoms. If the baby's being breastfed, then the mum needs to remove cow's milk from her own diet. If it's a formula-fed baby who's developed a cow's milk protein proctocolitis, then they need to be put onto a milk-free diet. So the extensively hydrolyzed milk formulas be suitable for children like that. And the prognosis of milk protein proctocolitis is that it's got a very good prognosis, and the symptoms, the condition usually resolves by the time the child is a year of age. And at a year, you can just switch the children onto normal cow's milk, as you would do any other baby.
We often get adults and parents of children coming in and saying that they think their child, or that they have an intolerance, which is sort of somewhat more nebulous and somewhat harder to pin down. How would you approach that sort of consultation?
I think, again, once I'd start off with taking them taking an allergy-focused clinical history once again. The reactions, there's a couple of things that we see in small children which patients commonly worry about. For example, children getting rashes after they eat tomatoes or tomato sauce, tomato ketchup. What we tell them is that tomatoes contains things called vasoactive amines, which are very similar to the stuff that your body produces when it has an allergic reaction. The other type of food that infants often have problems with are flares of eczema after they eat citrus fruit, and this is due to salicylates that are contained within the citrus fruit that can make the eczema flare up. I think anything beyond that, then I'd suggest avoidance of the food for about 6 weeks, and then a trial of reintroduction to see if the symptoms recur.
It's quite common for people to be worried about gluten, and usually in general practice we would obviously first exclude celiac disease. But if you have a parent or an adult who's convinced that they have a problem with gluten, that they're intolerant to it, and we know they don't have celiac disease, how would you handle that situation?
So I'd probably reassure them, just check what are the symptoms that they're getting. Suggest a trial of exclusion for about 6 weeks, see if the symptoms come back again once they reintroduce the gluten. If they do, then that patient most likely has non-celiac gluten sensitivity, which is becoming increasingly common. They need to be on a gluten-free diet or just to eat gluten as much as they're able to tolerate it, if they can tolerate a little bit without getting symptoms from it. And I probably signpost them to the Celiac Society, who are very good at supporting patients. Other allergy organisations which we commonly signpost patients to are, first of all, any patient who is at risk of anaphylaxis, we refer them to or signpost them to the Anaphylaxis Campaign. And the other organisation that we often signpost patients to is Allergy UK. Allergy UK have a lot of patient information leaflets about everything. The Anaphylaxis Campaign have support groups across the country, which are usually patient-led, and are very good discussion groups.
That's really useful to know. I think that's all we wanted to cover today, so thank you very much.
That's okay. Thank you for inviting me.